The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I basically just think it would be interesting to look at the emergence of a criminal economy.
And also, I'm always amazed that there aren't more profiles of her out there.
This really subversive, strange thing, in rap especially.
And see what their lives are like on both sides of the border.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Hi, I'm Craig. I'll be taking care of you tonight. The specials are on the board. I would highly recommend the veal shank. Also, we're sort of known for our burger. It's a half pound of grass-fed beef served with Gruyere cheese and our signature house-made ketchup. That's right. Our ketchup is made in-house with freshly diced tomatoes, a pinch of sugar, a touch of paprika, and it's disgusting. It's truly gross. Nobody likes it. But it's 100% fresh, and it 100% sucks. Our ketchup is kind of an homage to an American classic, a foul, grotesque homage. It's the 2011 remake of Footloose, of ketchups. Bumpy. Bumpy is a word I would use to describe our ketchup. Also, f***ed up. That's another way I would describe it. Now, I noticed when I first mentioned that we make our own ketchup, you looked excited. You probably thought, wow, what a fresh, organic experience I'm about to have. My entire life, I've been conditioned to enjoy a corporate version of ketchup, and I have been deprived of what ketchup actually is supposed to taste like. Couple of things. One, don't think about ketchup like that. It's ketchup. Two, maybe you need to accept that Heinz just happened to perfect ketchup. That's why it has a crap ton of money. It makes really good ketchup. It is number one, and we're like number 4 billion, you know? We're just below the ooze that streams out of the alien's mouth and onto Sigourney Weaver's face. And above that is Hunt's. So anyway, that's our ketchup. It sucks. Now that that's out of the way, we also do our own little spin on chicken nuggets. And, like the ketchup, they're disgusting.
Hey, Craig, can I talk to you in the back, please?
And I'm being fired. Thank you.
We Do Our Own Little Spin on Ketchup by Seth Reese. That piece was performed by Bill Hader of Saturday Night Live and Trainwreck fame. His new show, Barry, premieres on HBO in March. Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. My colleague Masha Gessen has written or translated more than a dozen books. One is about genetics, one about mathematics, and she's written a biography of Vladimir Putin, not an authorized biography by any means. And her most recent is titled, The Future is History, How Totalitarianism Reclaimed Russia. Gessen came to this country with her family as a teenager, but she did something that most immigrants don't. She moved back and forth between the United States and Russia as an adult. She's worked in Russia as a journalist and as a gay rights activist at a time when both of those occupations have become very dangerous. And her experience positioned Masha Gessen almost uniquely to write about Vladimir Putin's Russia and Donald Trump's America and how they intersect at this very fraught moment.
Masha, there's so much to talk about, but I have to begin with this. You began a recent piece for The New Yorker by saying, either jokingly or seriously, that somehow by being born in Russia, in totalitarian Soviet Union, that was the perfect preparation for being a journalist in America today.
Right. So I think there's I've perfected the genre of the unfunny joke. I think that's what it is.
But you're after something there. What is it? What are you talking about?
You know, when I'm not joking about having built a career in the backs of dictators and demagogues, it's there are things that I recognize. It's like I was gifted with this special pair of eyeglasses when I was born, and because I was brought up sort of in opposition to the regime, I see things, and like you know, I see them. I can point them out, which to me feels pretty easy, and then other people see them too, and that's like the trick that I get to play over and over again since Trump got elected.
Okay, so then let's start with your story before we begin with our crazy story, the national story. You were born in Moscow when, and in what kind of milieu?
So I was born in Moscow in 1967. I come from the intelligentsia. My grandmother lived in the Writers Union building, which is where I spent most of my childhood. And then when I went back to live in Moscow, I lived there as well. So a very particular kind of Moscow intellectual Jewish environment.
And you had two grandmothers who did radically different things.
Well, actually, my two grandmothers did the exact same thing. They were both translators. By the time I was growing up, they were both translators. They translated from different languages. And they were also best friends. But one of them, sort of according to family legend, was the conformist. And she had worked as a censor under Stalin. And the other one, according to family legend, never conformed and was always fearless, and she was always fearless, and never compromised. And then as I started researching the book, I realized that she had actually accepted a job with the secret police, because the secret police at the time really needed translators from Hebrew because the State of Israel had just come into existence. And they had already exterminated everybody who spoke Hebrew in the Soviet Union. And so they had a very difficult time finding someone. They found my grandmother.
So people listening will think to themselves, well, wait a minute, Masha, you say you came from, you know, dissident or dissident-ish and intelligentsia circles. One grandmother was a censor, the other one was in the secret police, not so dissident.
She didn't actually get the job in the secret police because she failed her medical exam. It turned out she had found out at the age of 28 or whatever it was that she was blind in one eye. She argued she wasn't going
perfect
for a job.
Perfect for a spy.
I know. Well, and she argued that she wasn't going for a job as a sniper. You know, who cares if a translator is blind in one eye? But that didn't go for very well. So for my other grandmother, she was always, I think, very ashamed of having been a censor. But she also articulated that as a moral choice. And that, to me, was the most interesting thing about the whole story, is that she said she was educated to be a history teacher. And she said, but as a history teacher, I would have had to lie to children every day. So I couldn't do that. So I got a job as a censor. And that was, in her view, it was a mechanical job. Someone else would have blacked out all the same words that she blacked out.
So, Masha, your family decided at a certain point when you were a teenager, I guess you were 12, 13?
Right.
Time to go. This is now the mid-70s. It's the middle of what's called the era of stagnation, Zastoy, under Brezhnev. Why did your family decide to leave? And you're also leaving behind a lot of people.
So, you know, first of all, everyone who decided to leave in the 70s, and we ended up, it took a few years to get out, so we ended up leaving in 1981. Everyone was convinced that the Soviet Union was going to last forever. And so they made their life choices based on that. Because it was going to last forever, the opportunity to build a different life elsewhere was worth just about any sacrifice, because nothing was ever going to change in that country. So for a lot of people, the fact that Perestroika started, you know, like 4 years after we left was a really difficult thing to come to terms with.
You had ambivalence about it, even as a teenager.
Well, I didn't want to leave. I wanted to stay where my friends were, where my grandmothers were. And my mother said, you know, in this country, you can either sacrifice your life to fighting the regime or leave. She said, you know, and this country never did enough for us to sacrifice our lives for fighting the regime.
So now here we are. Putin is still president. He's running for Russian president in March of 2018, and I'm betting that he's going to win. I want to take that controversial stand right now. I think he's going to win. And we're in the midst of a ongoing scandal having to do with Russia and the United States. And you are as ferocious a critic of Putin and Putinism as exists on this planet. And at the same time, you're very skeptical in certain ways of the scandal as you see it. I'd love to know what your position on this is right now as we see the president continue to praise the Russian president. There have been indictments handed down by Robert Mueller. There's probably more to come. This scandal is likely to go on for months and months more. And yet you're skeptical of it.
You know, I think that several things can be true at the same time. It can be true that Russians meddled in the election, and it can be true that Trump is not pursuing the kind of policy toward Russia that would be reasonable and at this point legally mandated. I mean, he's not imposed sanctions that he is legally mandated to impose, and that Russian interference, we still don't know whether it had a decisive effect on the election, and I'm very skeptical of that connection, right? I'm very skeptical of using Russian interference to explain Trump, right?
But you're not skeptical of it being a factor or a reality.
No, I'm not skeptical of it being a factor or a reality. I just think that
I'm separating you. In other words, what I'm trying to get at is Glenn Greenwald, among others,
right,
believes that in large measure, not to be unfair to him, but in large measure, that this is a digression from what we should be concentrating on, and really the so-called scandal is no scandal at all. That we're putting too much trust in institutions like the FBI, the CIA, et cetera.
I completely agree with Glenn Greenwald that's a digression, right? Because we don't have, you know, infinite mental bandwidth, and even the papers that have infinite internet still don't have infinite column inches. And every column inch that's devoted to the Mueller probe is not devoted to some other thing that the Trump administration is doing that I think often is more important. But a few months ago,
how can it not be important that the Russian secret services interfered with an American election? Whether it was decisive or not, well, I don't think we'll ever know. But that's a very important thing.
Well, so the kind of interference that we're talking about, right? If we're talking about Twitter bots, and basically if the theory of the case, and that's the theory in the intelligence report, the declassified intelligence report from last December, if the theory of the case is that Russians influenced American public opinion, that really kind of isn't much of a scandal. There, I agree with Glenn Greenwald. That's what,
because of the history of active measures on both sides?
Because of the history of active measures of both sides, because public opinion is influenced by any number of factors. And I think that the statement that a foreign power could not be allowed to influence the public opinion of a country actually is a statement that needs to be defended. It can't be taken for granted.
When you read about in The New Yorker or The New York Times and elsewhere about Trump's business dealings, the fact that he clearly could not get cash at a certain point from American banks and therefore went to Deutsche Bank and Russian sources and started doing branding exercises abroad with all kinds of characters, Russian and not, Azerbaijani, Georgian, people who are highly, highly corrupt. Do you not worry that he is in some way influenced by this and behaves politically in a certain way because of his...
You know, I actually think that Trump, who has never paid his debts and who is known for screwing over everybody that he deals with, I think the theory that he can be financially beholden to somebody is a little bit tricky to advance. I think it is important that we have a thoroughly corrupt president who is using his office to make money, right? And that he has come in with all sorts of baggage and habits and connections that are corrupt. But that's the direction I would go in with that information, not the direction of, oh, he's beholden to Putin, because actually I don't think this guy can be beholden financially to anybody.
How would you assess the scorecard so far in this country in terms of Trump's authoritarian instincts, his desire to put pressure on all kinds of democratic political assumptions and institutions that we have, and what's broadly called the resistance? Who's winning?
See, I don't think it's actually a question of who's winning. I think it's a question of how much we're losing, right? Because an easy way to sort of comfort yourself is to say, but look, you know, all the stuff that was here yesterday is still here. We still have the courts. We still have, you know, we still have the New York City government. We still have sanctuaries. We still have all sorts of stuff. The fact that we still have them is not surprising. You know, it took hundreds of years to build them. It's what we've lost, right? And I think that we've lost a lot. Now,
what have we lost? That's maybe the most important thing to assess.
So I think we've lost an ability to have a political conversation. And again, you know, that didn't start yesterday. That didn't start with Trump. But he really has stomped it into the ground.
What do you mean by that? It seems like all we have is political conversations.
No, we have conversations about politics. But we don't, I mean, a political conversation is a conversation in which people with different views come to agreements about how they're going to inhabit the society together. We don't see that happening in Congress. We don't see that happening in the streets. We don't see that happening, I think, at kitchen tables. I think at maximum we see sort of temporary compromises about how to get the, you know, how to keep the government
functioning.
Mm-hmm. Right? But, you know, imagine a Congress in which Republicans and Democrats come to the table again with different ideas about immigration, right? Not with an effort to stem the tide to minimize the damage of the war on immigrants, or an effort to maximize the damage, but with different ideas about how we're going to think about immigration and this country vis-a-vis immigration and the people who are coming in, and you know, like. That will be a political discussion.
I know that prediction is the lowest form of journalism, but how far and how long do you think Trump and Trumpism will last?
Can we go back to whether Putin is going to win the presidential election on March 18th?
That's easier.
I'm pretty sure of that one. I don't know. I mean, and the thing is that if it doesn't last, if he doesn't last, then as Tim Snyder has said, we will never know what we've prevented.
We'll never know just how fragile things are?
Right, just how bad it could have gotten. Right. I think there's a possibility that the Democrats will rally in this year and, you know, retake Congress and this tide will be turned. I'm not terribly optimistic about it. I think there are huge things in the way of getting that done, but it's possible. So I'm not making predictions. I'm just being the hysteric in the room.
Masha Gessen, the hysteric in the room. That's her words, not mine. Writes for the New Yorker so brilliantly, and I have nothing but gratitude for you. Thank you so much, David, for coming by.
Thank you.
Masha Gessen joined us as a staff writer just last year. It's the New Yorker Radio Hour. Much more to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from the New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs, because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Welcome back. When Francisco Cantu graduated from college with a degree in international relations, he did something that surprised his mother. He decided to join the Border Patrol. He told his mother that it would give him a perspective on border issues that was missing from his classroom. She was skeptical. She told him, "You make it sound like you'll be communing with nature and having heartfelt conversations all day." Those heartfelt conversations, no surprise, never happened. But Cantu wrote a book reflecting on the 4 years he spent on the Border Patrol in the deserts of Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas. It's called, and it's a lovely title, "The Line Becomes a River." And although Cantu clearly takes a liberal view, one that's critical of border policy, there are some on the left who have attacked him in the book as too complicit somehow with the policies that he was carrying out. Francisco Cantu spoke with staff writer Sarah Stillman, who's covered immigration and the border for The New Yorker.
So really early in the book, you have this difficult conversation with your mother about your decision to join Border Patrol. And she points out that you've just graduated with a college degree in international relations, and she kind of implies the job is beneath you. And you say that you're sick of reading about the border in books and you want to be on the ground. So I'm wondering if you can just tell us a little bit more about why you joined the Border Patrol.
I think my mom would be really terrified to hear this. Well, she knows this now. I think she would have been terrified to hear it at the time. But because she was a park ranger while I was growing up, and because we lived in the Southwest and I had grown up close to the desert, I think that's kind of one of the essential components of what I felt was missing from being at university and college and doing all this book learning about the border and about immigration. You know, I went to school in D.C., so very far from the border itself. And all of that learning felt disconnected from, you know, the realities of the landscape and the people and the culture that I knew growing up. And so that was part of it. And, of course, another part of it was that sort of idealism that you have as a 23-year-old when, you know, you're just coming out of college. And I think I was also idealistic, thinking that I would be able to sort of, you know, enter this large system, as a lot of young people do, I think, enter this large institution and sort of remain intact with my morals and my ethics and, like, move through it and just, you know, collect observations and answers. And I thought that I would really see things that would help me unlock these questions about the border, about immigration. I thought I would, you know, then I told myself I'd be able to become an amazing policymaker or some great immigration lawyer.
Do you look back on that as naive? Or I remember your mother says in the book, you know, the Border Patrol is not the Park Service. It is a paramilitary police force.
I do look back on that as being naive. I think, especially when you're a young person, you have so much confidence in yourself and who you are. And when you join an institution, you begin to lend all of these parts of yourself and your identity and, you know, your soul in order to, you know, help the institution accomplish its goals, further the institutional goals. And And that happens in subtle ways, slowly. And so I think, you know, by the time I was out in the field doing the job, I had already put aside a lot of those questions just in order to be able to do the work. And I think, you know, that really terrified somebody like my mom, who was the one person, you know, holding me accountable, vigilantly watching, you know, to see if I was losing track of myself and who I was and the person that I had been outside of that job.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about the work. I mean, you really go into the nitty-gritty of, you know, the daily field work of being a Border Patrol agent. And I'm wondering if you can tell us just what you actually did, what you encountered on a typical day in the field. What was the work like at a granular level?
You know, I think when I first entered the job, there were a lot of things that I was very drawn to. First and foremost, being outside. I mean, I love the desert. And I've never been closer to a landscape than the area that I worked, where I got my field training and where I worked for those first 2 years as an agent. And of course, you do all of this disconnecting between what you're learning and what it is that you're learning it for. You know, to me, it was to learn how to track and to learn how to, you know, cut for sign, as we call it, to learn every pass in a given range of mountains, to know every mile marker of a stretch of highway. You know, that was, in a way, exhilarating. But of course, looking back on it, you're learning to understand a landscape in order to capture people. And of course, that's not what you're thinking at the time. At the time, you're thinking, wow, I'm learning so much. And then you know, there's the regular stuff that you would expect, you know, like car chases, drug busts. And I think that can be really distracting. But when I left the Border Patrol and I look back on it, what really sticks out to me are those human moments, those interactions, you know, all that other, you know, stuff that might seem exciting faded away. And what I was left with, you know, was trying to grapple with all these people that I had apprehended and interacted with. And then, you know, they had been risking their lives to cross the desert. And at the end of the day, I was taking them back to a cell and sending them back to the places that they were risking their lives to flee.
Yeah, right. On that note, you actually write about destroying the supplies of migrants at one point, that water gets destroyed, blankets, food, the stuff that's left along the crossing routes. Why does Border Patrol do this? And why did, if I understand correctly, you do this?
You know, when I was being trained, I actually never witnessed this happen, and I never partook in that. But, you know, I had it kind of like explained very casually by you know, by like the training agents, you know, like, oh, you get rid of all of their supplies, and then it just makes it makes it easier because then they'll quit and they'll come out to the road. It's easier to catch them, you know, and that's just, that's such a short-sighted, deadly thinking. And so for me, you know, having seen a dead body in the desert, when I think about that man, he died from dehydration in August, in, you know, the hottest part of the summer. And if he had found a water bottle, if he had had access to that aid, like, he would have lived, because people are lost and disoriented, and people lose their lives that way.
So there's not a ton of politics in the book. And, of course, in the age of Trump, where the border is so heavily politicized, it was striking for me to realize how much, at least in the beginning of the book, you really process being an agent as a physical challenge, a challenge of the landscape in some ways. And of course, we hear the president and his rhetoric around what a wall would do for us. But having seen it on the ground, what's your sense of that?
In the station where I worked, we had several miles of 20-foot-high steel mesh fencing. And my experience with the wall is that smugglers had figured out a way to pry open these steel panels and, using hydraulic jacks, you know, lift them high enough that they could drive vehicles underneath. And for just a group of people, they would weld an opening big enough for people to crawl through. And so I don't think that that's an argument for a bigger, stronger, more impenetrable barrier. I think that that shows us that no matter what obstacle we put at the border, it's going to be subverted. You know, people will find a way up, over, under, around it. And, you know, what we also know is that, you know, if we keep building more walls, if we hire more Border Patrol agents, we've done both of those things. We know that the same consequences will happen. You know, last year, how many times did you hear that crossings were down, right? I think crossings were at their lowest point in 14 years for a while. And you heard that over and over again. But what we haven't heard is that the border deaths along the desert actually went up. So, you know, for me, when I think about that fact, it's not abstract to me. What I think about is the man whose body I encountered in the desert. And, you know, I remember what he looked like, and I remember these details like, you know, the ants crawling across his body, or like the foam that collected at the edges of his mouth. And what I think about even more than that man are the two boys who were with him. He was with his 19-year-old nephew and the nephew's friend. They're all from the same village. They made the crossing together. They got lost and left behind. And I was the person, because I spoke the best Spanish of the people who were there, who had to explain to these boys who wanted to stay with his body, who wanted to bring his body back to the village where they came from. Because in Mexico and in so many other places in Latin America or Central America, if you don't have the body, you have nothing. You don't know what happened to that person. And so I had to explain to them why they had to leave the body. And all I had were these bureaucratic, you know, okay, the county medical examiner is going to come and determine the cause of death, and then the body will be turned over to the Mexican consulate, and you'll contact the Mexican consulate. Maybe the Mexican consulate will give you some paperwork that you can bring to your family. Then you'll rearrange with them for the repatriation of the body. And, you know, I remember that those boys just nodded because they saw a man in uniform telling them things, and they knew that they had to nod.
It seems to have also taken a physical and psychological toll on you. At one point in the book, you visit your dentist. You find out you had started to grind your teeth. And your dentist actually looks in your mouth and says, quote, "It's getting kind of ugly in there." So did you understand in real time what was happening to you, and what was your body telling you?
That moment in the dentist's office was an interesting moment for me, because I think Border Patrol, much like any law enforcement, is sort of, the culture is such that you don't really talk about your work, or you don't really talk about the ways that you might be internalizing violence, right? And even if you had asked me during that time, you know, how are you? I would have been fine. Like, how's your job? Oh, it's fine. But that moment, I had all these dreams where my teeth were crumbling out, or where I was clenching my jaws and couldn't stop clenching them, to the point to where like my teeth would explode inside of my mouth. And so when I went to the dentist after having those dreams for years, and he said, you know, you've ground through several layers of the enamel on your teeth, I was like, that was the first time I had a real world manifestation of that sort of like subconscious creeping horror. And I think a lot of people ask me about that in interviews, and it almost makes me uncomfortable to like talk about having bad dreams, because, you know, I was, that entire time I was in a position of power and privilege over people. And I think that grappling with power and our relationship to it, and what do we do once we, you know, realize the ways that we've wielded power, I think that's another really important part of the conversation that we're having right now.
How have your former Border Patrol colleagues interpreted the book, if they've read it?
So I've shared the book primarily with former colleagues that are somehow represented in the book or people in the Border Patrol that I was close to. So kind of just a handful of agents. And the response from a lot of them has been sort of, oh, I didn't realize you were having such a hard time. I didn't realize that the work was hard for you. One of my coworkers called me just last week because he had finished reading the book, and he said, hey, man, I want to apologize. Like, I'm so sorry. I could kind of tell that something was amiss, and I never asked you about it. And I said, you know, don't apologize. Like, it's not the culture of the Border Patrol, just like it's not the culture of the military or law enforcement or any of these sort of hyper-masculine worlds to talk about how sort of violence and might be affecting you, like the violence that you partake in, how you might be internalizing that.
You wrote that your parents initially planned to name you Joshua Tyler Cantu Simmons instead of Francisco Cantu. And you also write that if that name had stuck, you would be a different person. And so I thought that was a very salient point in a book that's partly about the arbitrary nature of the lines that we draw. So I'm just wondering how you would be different if you were Joshua Simmons. Would you have written this book? Could this book exist?
My mom talks a lot about that. And you know, what she says is that, you know, at the hospital, they made her put a name on the birth certificate before leaving with me, and they hadn't really decided. And she was with my dad, who she very soon after I was born separated from, and they had talked about this name, Joshua and Tyler. And then, like, as soon as I got home, you know, my mom started calling me this other name. And, you know, by the time I was becoming adult, like, that name, you know, like, that's what drew me to speak Spanish. I mean, I was like, I can't go through the world as Francisco Cantu not speaking Spanish. But
oh,
I didn't,
so grow,
didn't
grow
up,
up
speaking Spanish.
Okay.
My mother didn't grow up speaking Spanish. And so, I mean, I think it just kind of goes to show you the power of a name. You know, a name is a reminder of where you're from. And it's also sort of a reminder of, like, your parents' hope for you in the world.
Francisco Cantu was a Border Patrol agent from 2008 to 2012. His new book is The Line Becomes a River, and he spoke with Sarah Stillman, a staff writer for The New Yorker. In a moment, you can forget the Golden Globes and ignore the Oscars. We're going to bring you the film awards that really matter. The Brodies. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
I'm David Remnick, and next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour, Jennifer Lawrence joins me to talk about her new film, Red Sparrow, a spy thriller set in Vladimir Putin's Russia. Next week, Jennifer Lawrence. Now,
A well-made spy movie is completely up my alley, and that's despite the very best efforts of my old friend and colleague, Richard Brody. We've been seeing movies together ever since we were in college, when Richard was always dragging me off to see some obscure film set in, I don't know, medieval Japan, or a drama in Sweden, and always, always films by his favorite, Jean-Luc Godard.
Pourquoi vous êtes triste?
Parce que je suis triste.
Cet idiot. Pourquoi tu es triste? C'est mieux quand je dis vous ou tu.
Pareil, je peux pas me passer de toi.
Tu peux très bien.
Oui, mais je veux pas.
Richard Brody's been writing about film for The New Yorker for over a dozen years now, and I sat down with him and our colleague Alexandra Schwartz and some popcorn and some M&Ms. And we talked about the movies that he thinks should be in contention for the top awards this year. It's the alternative Oscars.
The Brodies.
The Brodies.
I think we need a whole new name, the Brodies.
So we're going to get Richard Brody's take on Best Picture of 2017, the movies you should have seen and maybe still can. Richard, it's all yours.
Well, first and foremost, this is the year of Get Out. Get Out is Jordan Peele's first film as director and writer. And it's a horror film of sorts.
Do they know I'm black?
Should they?
You might wanna, you know.
Mom and Dad, my black boyfriend will be coming up this weekend. I just don't want you to be shocked that he's a black man.
A film that uses the tropes of horror films to tell a story of a different kind of horror, namely America's racist horror. It's, in effect, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, that turns into a explosion of the ugliness underlying white liberal wokeness.
Do you smoke in front of my daughter?
I'm gonna quit.
She'd take care of that for you.
How?
Hypnosis.
I'm good, actually.
No, but Get Out is going to do well at the Oscars, won't it?
I think Get Out is maybe the only movie on your list that also has official Academy approval.
That's exactly right. And as well it should, because, among other things, it's an immensely entertaining film. Jordan Peele is a very funny man. The movie is not a comedy, but it's full of funny things.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, Richard, so what's your next selection for Best Picture nominee?
Meantime, I'm going to have an M&M or two.
Well, number two for me is A Quiet Passion. It's Terence Davis's biopic, the British director, Terence Davis's biopic of Emily Dickinson. Cynthia Nixon stars as Emily Dickinson.
Let's watch this.
Clip?
Oh, absolutely.
Do you guard your soul, Emily?
As best as I am able, sir.
And hell? What of hell?
Avoid it if I can. Endure it if I must.
That was irreligious, young lady.
Then I beg God's pardon for my impiety.
Her performance is remarkable. She brings a rhetorical lilt, a kind of bright-eyed energy with a tragic undertone to every element of the movie, to the comedy, to the pain, to the religious elements, to the family drama. But what's extraordinary about her performance goes together with the film itself. It's in part a screwball comedy, with lacerating epigrams.
Emily Dickinson was always known as a hilarious figure in American poetry.
Well, what he reveals is that her humor is a kind of bitter satire on the narrowness of New England mores, to which she was painfully subjected, until the movie becomes a tragedy of physical, emotional, and spiritual sufferings.
Perfect.
We're moving on, yeah? Okay. The third movie on your list, Richard, is one I've seen and I also loved, Good Time.
Good Time it's a kind of modernist refraction of the New York crime story, directed by the young New York-based directors Josh and Benny Safdie, starring, of all people, Robert Pattinson, as a small-time Queens gangster who ropes his developmentally disabled brother into a robbery that goes wrong.
Just keep your head now.
Turn around!
He's all right, we didn't throw
it. Get back here!
What was the gangster movie you wanted me to see a film for him that I missed?
That was it.
Yeah.
Good Time.
Good Time.
Because they were showing it.
It's Coming Back. It's great.
Yeah.
Excellent. That was my favorite movie last year. And I think Robert Pattinson requested to be in a Safdie Brothers movie, right? He had seen a still or something from their previous movie and really wanted to act with them.
Yeah, Robert Pattinson has a very unusual and sophisticated taste in terms of the movies that he wants to appear in.
How so?
Back in 2008, when he was interviewed in the midst of a Twilight junket, he was asked about his favorite films. Number three on his list was Jean-Luc Godard's First Name Carmen, which he cited in French.
That's why you put him on the list.
That's why.
As the biographer of Jean-Luc Godard, that's why you put him on the list.
He has certified good taste.
Your secret is out, Brody. What's your next selection?
Next selection is A Ghost Story. It's directed by David Lowery, and it's a movie that takes its title literally. A young man, played by Casey Affleck, dies in a car accident and comes back as a ghost and re-inhabits the house in which he had lived with his now widow, Rooney Mara.
Forget.
Oh, there's the trailer. The trailer's to the right.
Oh, the trailer.
All to the right, number two, to the right.
When I was little, we used to move all the time. I would write these notes, and I would fold them up really small, and I would hide them.
It does seem like kind of an inspired idea to have the ghost be just a sheet, like in an elementary school play or something. There's something very beautiful about that.
It is very beautiful, and what he does with it is kind of amazing. Ghost Story is a beautiful, delicate film. Lowery takes this almost cartoonish conceit and turns it into something graceful, choreographic. It's mildly comedic, but it's intensely romantic, tender, and metaphysically exquisite.
I'm going to make a confession. I saw the trailer to this, and it didn't appeal. Was the trailer particularly off, or was I particularly off?
Both
are possible.
No, many trailers are off, because they take usually what's most unusual about a film and eliminate it.
Yeah. I think we've got one more film on your list.
My final selection is a French film called Slack Bay. It's by the director Bruno Dumont, and it's a really compound film. It's set around 1910. It involves aristocrats and mussel harvesters in a seaside resort.
Not weightlifters, but actual mussel harvesters.
Actual mussel harvesters.
Different kind of mussel beach.
Who also happen to be cannibals.
Quel bonheur à chaque fois de retourner sur cette côte. Oui, regardez là-bas, ces cueilleurs de moules.
Interesting. That's a lot of elements.
Oh, there are more elements. There's a romance between the children of the two families, the son of the mussel harvesters and the daughter of the aristocrats, who may in fact be a boy dressed as a girl, unless she's a girl dressed as a boy.
It's amazing that this film did not get widespread support at the Academy. So, Richard, imagine I'm making a drum roll. Who's going to win in the Brody Awards? Who should?
Who should? Get Out. Get Out should win. Get Out is a visionary film. It's not just a film of political fervor. It's also a film of true cinematic vision. Jordan Peele does something that very few first-time directors manage to do. He directs every moment. His control of tone is exquisite. He turns this film into the American equivalent of a Buñuel film, where with point of view, with sardonic angles, with close-ups, with performances, he conjures the inner life of his protagonist. And that inner life is a very grim place.
Richard, earlier you wrote a post on NewYorker.com saying that, in fact, the Academy Awards this time around, nominations, are all over the place. You've got low-budget films, high-budget films. If I can extract from that, I think it's obvious to say that the world of streaming has influenced, and maybe the death of theaters or a lot of theaters is influencing the way things are going. Are you getting a little warmer and fuzzier about the Academy than you used to?
The Academy is reflecting changes in the industry overall, which is to say that there used to be essentially one Hollywood, and now there are multiple Hollywoods. There's the ultra-big-budget Hollywood of superhero movies, but that's not, and that's what makes money, but that's not how the studios want to see themselves. Studios want to see themselves in terms of humanistic, progressive productions. And those movies are no longer being made by studios. They're being made on lower budgets by independent producers with people who work or have worked in Hollywood. In effect, off-Hollywood movies. And that's the kind of movie that, by and large, gets nominated for Oscars.
So I just want to know, of the films that are on the Academy's list for Best Picture, what do you approve of, for example?
Well, there are a couple of films that I think very highly of. Greta Gerwig's Lady Bird, which is a magnificently written and acted film, a vigorously directed film, which at moments has absolute flashes of illumination, of transfiguration.
And it's also an historic moment, right? Because I think that Greta Gerwig is, what, the fifth woman to be ever nominated for Best Director?
Exactly.
And does she have a chance?
I think she does have a chance, and deservedly. Paul Thomas Anderson's film Phantom Thread is one of the best movies of the year.
It doesn't have a chance.
Why
does it not have a chance? I ask this in ignorance. I would like to see it have a chance.
It'll feel odd. It'll feel slow. I mean, remember who's voting.
Well, the Academy is actually doing a better job of recruiting more active members and a more diverse membership. But ultimately, the Oscars are the movie industry's, Hollywood's, image of itself. And that image is the kind of image that Gene Kelly puts forth at the very beginning of Singin' in the Rain. Dignity, always dignity. And that's why a movie like Phantom Thread, which is really emotionally violent and emotionally eccentric, or a movie like Get Out, which challenges Hollywood's own progressive image of itself, are not likely to win.
What's going to win?
I think that the Shape of Water is going to win.
Why?
The Shape of Water is a romance between two different kinds of beings. In this case, a woman and an aquatic creature who resembles the creature from the Black Lagoon. And it's set in the 1950s, where these two creatures are explicitly struggling with prejudices of the time. So on the one hand, it flatters Hollywood's own sense of itself as progressive. And on the other hand, it's fighting the battles of the 1950s, so to speak.
So what would surprise you in this year's Oscars? Is there any chance that something that you love could run away with it?
Well, I think that Lady Bird has a pretty good chance, actually. If it were a regular political election, I would say that The Shape of Water, Lady Bird, and Get Out are going to split votes. And that, in effect, Shape of Water will squeak through because of a certain division between partisans of Get Out and partisans of Lady Bird.
I would love to see Lady Bird win, and I'd love to see Get Out win. I think my own vote would be split between those two.
I agree. And I also think the Golden State Warriors are going to win. Richard, Alex, thank you very much.
David, thank you.
Thanks. Alex, thanks very much. You can check out Richard Brody on film at newyorker.com. He's writing about new and interesting stuff all the time. Alexandra Schwartz writes about books and many other subjects. I'm David Remnick, and we're going to wrap up today by taking a little trip with the novelist Chang Rae Lee, who's published many stories and essays in The New Yorker. He was born in South Korea and grew up in Westchester, New York. And when he was in his 40s, he spent a year in Hawaii on sabbatical, and he's been going back there about once a year ever since. But the place he wanted to take us was not some breathtaking, unspoiled beach. Instead, Chang Rae Lee picked a store called Don Quixote, a big box store on a nondescript intersection in Honolulu.
We lived here for a year, about 10 years ago. This was the closest store to where we lived, and I just thought it was a regular supermarket. But when you come in, you realize, wow, it really is, you know, the entire world here in these aisles.
It's the kind of place that if you went to Hawaii as a tourist, you'd probably never take notice of it.
It's for, you know, the frugal shopper. And that's always the shopper that I'd always been. I'd always shopped with my mother, and this is, we'd come to stores just like this, stores like Caldor's and Corvette's. And it, for us back then, as immigrants to New York, New York suburbs, you know, every trip was, at least in the beginning, was a kind of discovery of what was here. Not just in the store, of course, but in the land. And in the same way, you know, if you come to Don Quixote, you know, it's a kind of a different sort of welcome to this place. There's so many items here. I can't believe, they must have a whole crew of people just trying to figure out how to restock all this stuff. Local Hawaiian products, Hawaiian-made products, you have just your sort of global brands. Then you have a lot of Korean and Japanese origin products. It's interesting just to think about that person deciding on you know, where to source these things, which ones are going to be popular, knowing, of course, their clientele, which is international, tourist, local. And then I think, you know, very basically just neighborhood people. There's a local brand of punch that my daughters like, so I definitely have to pick up some of that. I would normally buy some fresh produce and fish, some sashimi, but I have to go do a couple other errands. I have to pick up my family at the airport, so I don't want to obviously leave raw ahi in the car. we're going over to the punch section, but you stop here and look at this aisle. It has electric shavers, koa cushions, that's koa wood, car fragrances, and again, in Hawaii, car fragrances are huge, maybe because it's hot and kind of muggy. But then look, underneath car fragrances, Japan hair color. And they have hardware type items too. You know, military grade nylon paracord. I mean, why do you need this gauge of nylon paracord in 9 different colors? And then in the very next aisle, one of my favorite is the Japanese kitchenware. I just like looking through it and imagining what you might put in there. You know, a little oshinko or have your little shoyu dish and of course your noodle dish. But here's my juice. Yeah, paso guava, passion fruit guava. Got some new flavors. I think I'll just stick with that. This is probably my favorite section of the store. You have scallop poke, mussel poke. I love these little white crabs that you eat raw. They're marinated. I go to Whole Foods and I just, you know, with all their prepared foods, I just want to go to sleep. And again, this is not high-end sushi, but it's, you know, it's decent and it's beautiful and it's fresh. I hate going shopping in the places that we normally go shopping because I know what's there. And I think more and more we're running short of places where you can actually go and not know what you're going to get and have that part of the experience. I know that that's what shopping truly is, I suppose, but the ways that stores are now, they preclude discovery. Because we're always supposed to make things these days to sort of maximize our choices, right? We can Yelp everything. We can look through the social media and do the best job possible of getting the absolutely right product, which I think it's completely false. And we don't know what thing will actually make us, you know, give us that little pop of delight and pleasure. So this place invites you to take a chance. Mm-hmm. In fact, you have to.
2408.
There's always an opportunity for a conversation here, which is nice. They recognize that I'm sure lots of people are in a hurry, but you know, as in certain places, and Hawaii is one of them, if you're in a hurry, you're going to get in trouble.
The writer Chang Rae Lee at the Don Quixote store in Honolulu. And if you want to know why a giant Asian specialty grocery store in Hawaii calls itself Don Quixote, I can't enlighten you on that one. I'm David Remnick. That's it for the New Yorker Radio Hour. Next time, Jennifer Lawrence on the new thriller Red Sparrow. I hope you'll join us.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Cal Aaliyah, Karen Frillman, David Krasnow, Sarah Nix, Michael Raphael, Mythili Rao, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Terrence Bernardo, Emily Mann, and Jessica Henderson. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.